Welcome to Community First, a show where First Union organisers, activists and community leaders answer your questions and discuss the issues facing our communities. Community First is proudly brought to you by First Union, where we put workers first.
Good afternoon. You are on Community First FM. I am Robin. I am your host today. And we are here talking about the issues that are affecting workers in our communities across New Zealand, across Aotearoa today, the different developments in terms of your rights, the different issues that we're coming across, and talking about practical ways that we can address those issues. I will be joined later in the show by Lisa Metor-Fox, who is one of the organisers for First Union from the transport, logistics and manufacturing sector of our union. She will be talking to us about recent developments in labour hire contracting and what the potential implications of that will be for the wider workforce. There are a lot of people in these precarious working conditions, and she's been working very closely in the logistics sector about what different contracts people are put on and what the legal status of those people are, the highly insecure hours of work, the different treatment that people get, the complete insecurity of their livelihood and what that means for their families. So she'll be able to talk us through those issues a lot more. So we look forward to being joined by Lisa. We have also been working, of course, as a union on the issues that affect our members. So we have been preparing for negotiations in a lot of different sectors. We're the union for the finance sector, so Westpac, ANZ, BNZ and ASB. And I've been spending a lot of time at Westpac recently talking to workers there about how we can improve their position with regards to their upcoming contract negotiations. We're also talking about how do we stand up for ourselves, how do we counter things like bullying or mistreatment at work. And that's something that is a conversation that we have all around the country with all sorts of different workers, because unfortunately, if you're feeling like that, you aren't alone. It is a common problem, but it is also something that we can stand together and fight back against. So we will we discuss these sorts of issues as a union. I really encourage you all to join a union if you're able to, and seek support in those sorts of situations, but also reach out to the Citizens Advice Bureau, to the Human Rights Commission, if you feel like you're being discriminated against, because the worst thing to do, or the only way that you can ensure that that behaviour will continue, is if you do nothing. So you really do have the ability to stick up for yourself, to get help, and to know your rights as well, because every worker in this country has access to employment rights, and it's just a matter of knowing where you stand and building the confidence to stick up for yourself. Now we're going to play a song just to get ourselves started, and hopefully we can be joined by Lisa Metor-Fox very soon.
Huxtable type way. Miss Lady, it looks to me you need a little juice in your life. Call me when that big old house gets lonely, fight, and I'll teleport from here to there. You show me how it's supposed to be done. I'll make sure you have young fun. Pretty pink, baby blue. Right, don't, why don't you teach me something new? We're all just babies in my view. So crow, baby, pretty pink, baby blue. Right, don't, why don't you teach me something new?
Pink and Blue by Outkast, an oldie but a goodie. I've been joined by Lisa Mentor-Fox of First Union. Welcome, Lisa. How are you doing?
Hi. I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. So as I was talking before, if you caught the intro, Lisa's come in to talk to us all about labour hire contracts, specifically with her experience in the logistics sector, but also we can talk a little bit more about a recent case that has been won and gone in favour of labour hire workers who wanted to have more security around their contract and their status as workers. So we'll talk about that a little bit later, and I'm sure that there'll be plenty of other things that'll come up which are relevant to a lot of different workers, but with particular focus for labour hire contractors and their vulnerable positions. So maybe, Lisa, if you can explain to the listeners what your position is with First Union and what your involvement has been so far with the sector and these particular workers.
Yeah, so I'm an organiser with First Union, and I am the campaign coordinator for our labour hire campaign. So it's called Real Work, Real Jobs, and the concept there is just that, you know, if you're doing real work, you should have a real job. So for those of you who aren't really aware about labour hire workers, labour hire is often referred to as agency workers or sometimes temporary labour. But what we are increasingly seeing is triangular employment arrangements. So that's where perfect example is Foodstuffs. So Foodstuffs are the company who own New World and Pack and Save. So Foodstuffs will employ a lot of their people directly, but then they will also get in labour hire staff. So they will come from temping agencies, as a lot of people will refer to them as Drake or cover staff or first temp. So you might think that, oh, well, you know, those people are there temporarily, you know, just maybe to cover for a week or two, or, you know, maybe a busy season, a month. But what we've seen a lot in the logistics industry in particular, you know, Foodstuffs is not alone in this practice, is that they are actually, these labour hire so-called temporary workers are actually there for years. You know, I've come across people who have been working on these labour hire contracts for 2 years. You know, in a couple of instances, I've come across people who have been there at different companies, you know, for a decade, supposedly working as a labour hire worker, when in fact they've been in this distribution centre, you know, in this warehouse, for doing the same job, working alongside someone doing the exact same work, and the only difference is who is considered the employer.
Yeah, and so you're saying that they've actually worked in the exact same workplace. Maybe over the course of that decade they have been employed through various different agencies, but effectively they've been in the same workplace, and it's just been a matter of whose name's on the payslip effectively.
Yeah, that's right. So it's actually quite common for the individual labour hire worker to have been working for, you know, Drake is a good example, on that particular site for a decade, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, doing the exact same job, working 40, often 50, sometimes 60 hours a week, mm-hmm. Doing the exact same job as someone next to them, and you're right, yeah, the only difference is often the company employer name on the payslip, and you're right, sometimes these companies will decide to use a different labour hire agency, but the worker will remain the same, so the, yeah
absolutely. And in terms of the status of those workers, are they able to join a union and collectively bargain with their employer?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting point, particularly with regard to the case which you mentioned, which we're going to discuss a bit later. But everyone can join a union. It's called freedom of association. So it's just a basic human right, and it's in the Employment Relations Act. Anyone who wants to join a union can join a union, just like you could join any church that you wanted, or any sports club that you wanted. You can join a union if you wish. So we definitely do have labour hire workers in our union. I guess the difficulty just becomes who, you know, who's the employer, but we'll talk about that in more detail later. But yeah, so if you are a labour hire worker in this position and you're thinking to yourself, should I join the union? The best place to start is our labour hire workers network. And so that is online, is the easiest way to do it. If you just Google labour hire workers network, you can join us for free, straight away on there. We just ask for a couple of, you know, simple details, and that way you'll be in touch with us and we can communicate with you from there.
Great. Okay, no, that's really cool, and it's good to know that there is an easy way to get involved, but also to reassure people, well, not reassure, but remind people that wherever you are, whatever position you're in, whatever workplace, you can join a union. The difference being that there are some workplaces in New Zealand who have already gone through the process of what we'd call organising, where you have higher membership, you have an established collective agreement, you have more union activity on site. That's fantastic, and that's a great thing. If you are in one of those workplaces, make sure that you are in the union and participating in that process, to make sure that it responds to what your needs are and what your wishes are. But for a lot of people, and in my work, I work predominantly in the finance and retail sectors, and particularly when I'm talking to younger workers, a lot of people have no idea what a union is, for starters, and they've never worked in a workplace that has had any kind of union activity. So common areas of the work, of the market, so to speak, would be hospitality, cafes, bars, and that sort of thing. Very low union activity, because there are a lot of small employers, and if you think about it, working together as a group, as employees, it's easier to do that, and easier to have a to get union involvement on a larger scale. So a lot of your big companies will have union involvement, and that's fantastic. So our union, First Union, is the union for retail workers, finance, and banks, and insurance, logistics, like Lisa's saying, and she's been working with a lot of the food distribution area of that sector. We also have transport, so some of those bus drivers that you've been hearing about going on strike, some of the members of the trains have been members of First Union, and there's lots of different unions for the train workers, but you've been hearing more and more about workers sticking up for themselves and saying this isn't what we want, and we're drawing a line in the sand. And one of the things that I've been reminding our members of, and I've been having meetings with Westpac workers downtown in Britomart. A lot of those workers are catching the train and the bus to work. Last Friday had meetings where a lot of people had taken, you know, a lot longer than usual to catch the train to work. Not because the trains were on strike, they took a lot longer than usual to get to work, driving on the motorway or whatever it was. And I took that opportunity to talk to people about what is going on with the trains. A lot of people weren't aware, but I think it's really important to understand the reasoning for workers to take that step and to go on strike. And a lot of our listeners may not be aware, but the primary reason for that strike is that Transdev, the company that runs the trains, or is it Veolia? International company that has the contract for running the trains in Auckland, basically said, look, we want driver-only trains. We only want to pay one person to be on any one train at any given time. We don't see the need to pay the train managers, the people that are walking through the train, making sure that everyone's okay, making sure that everyone's safe, you know, coming into the stops, opening the doors, all sorts of different things. And for people that do the train manager job, obviously they don't want to lose their jobs, but also for the drivers, it's really important to them that they're not the only person on the train. And from a safety perspective for the customers and the passengers, this is a huge safety concern. And once I'd explained that to a lot of our workers at Westpac, they're thinking, wow, I'd hate to be on a train without those managers, because especially at night, finishing the late shift, all sorts of things happen on a train. Now I understand why those workers are sticking up, and I understand that it's been a huge sacrifice for them to go without pay today, to take a stand not only for themselves but also for us as passengers. So good to realise that that is happening, and that is something that you can do, as you have a right to go through that process if there's something that's felt strongly on your work site. Obviously all sorts of legal loopholes to jump through in order to make sure that it is a lawful strike action, so do involve a union. But really powerful message that they've sent to that company, so we'll watch that space. But in terms of particular, going back to the issue of labour hire workers, Lisa, in terms of particular businesses, is there some employers rely on labour hire workers more than others, or is there a particular trend across the industry?
So I just organise in logistics. So for those of you who don't know what logistics is when goods come into the country, you know, they're flowing into the country, or perhaps they come up from, you know, the farms down south or something like that, they all need to be stored somewhere, and they're stored in a huge warehouse,
mm-hmm.
Generally speaking in South Auckland, and we call those distribution centres. And then when the supermarkets or, you know, the retail chains want to restock their shelves, they call up the distribution centre and say, you know, we need 5 more tops and 10 more ice cream packs or chicken or whatever it is. Yep. So that's what a DC is. And so what we're finding is that actually a lot of very big employers are using labour hire in this really exploitative manner in their supply chain, in their distribution centre in particular. So... And for those of you who just tuned in, we're just discussing labour hire people. So this is where people are brought in supposedly on a temporary basis and are employed by a third party, a labour hire company, when in actual fact they are performing a permanent job and really should be, you know, just like you and I, and applying for that job directly. So, yeah. To go back to your question, Robin, yes, there are a lot of very large companies using these labour hire people in this really exploitative way. So, you know, the warehouse, their distribution centre were particularly bad. You know, I talked to a number of people who had worked as supposed labour hire workers for 11 years.
Wow. In the same distribution centre.
That's right, in the distribution centre in Wiri. So for 11 years, for 10 years, 9 years, and I did talk to these people directly. And they'd worked there continuously, and, you know, it's just common sense, isn't it, that if you work somewhere for this length of time that you actually are an employee of, in this situation, the warehouse. You're not a labour hire worker, you're not a temporary worker.
I mean,
I think anyone would say that that's just basic common sense. Thankfully, we were able to organise those workers and, you know, through action that the membership and the delegates took, those people have now been made permanent full-time direct employees of the warehouse.
Awesome.
Yeah. And we see the same thing at lots of other distribution centres, as I already mentioned previously, Foodstuffs, who own the New World and the Pack and Saves. They use labour hire as a business model in their distribution centres. We've been particularly active in their distribution centres because we have been going through bargaining. So for those of you who aren't aware, collective bargaining is where everyone gets together and goes and talks about the wage rise that they want and the terms and conditions that they want in a collective way, instead of doing that one-on-one. And so, yes, we have seen that in the Foodstuffs distribution centres. And, you know, we were coming across, I've got a guy at the moment, actually, who's worked on this distribution centre, admittedly part-time, but for 4 years. You know, he's a student. And it just boggles my mind, actually, because, you know, I always worked when I was a student, but I was a permanent part-time direct employee, you know. And so, yeah, there's some other quite big brands out there using these people in their distribution. So, you know, Kmart does it. I actually also realised that my food bag are doing it, which I have to say I was...
Wow.
Yes, I... Exactly. I was very disappointed because I actually use my food bag and part of why I made the decision to use them and not other... you know, competitors, was because I had heard that they were a really good employer and that they treated their staff really well and paid people really well and, you know, had a year parental leave and all these kinds of things.
Yeah.
So when I was talking to some of our membership and I realised that in actual fact in their supply chain, their cold store workers, so those who, you know, all the lovely fresh meats and veggies that I myself get delivered to my door are stored before they come to me, were actually the majority of them were labour hire workers.
Wow.
And, yeah, I was really, really disappointed. And I actually am going to write to my food bank and let them know that that's not good enough. You know, they need to not only be ensuring that the people in their office are being paid well and treated well, they need to make sure that the people in their supply chain are as well. So, they actually recently, my food bank, have built a distribution centre themselves. And so I would be very interested to dig further and see if they are still using such high levels of labour hire. Because, you know, there's just no excuse. They should be using employing these people directly.
Awesome. And can I ask a question? And this is just on behalf of listeners who may not be savvy with these different business practices, but it's probably pretty obvious to us, but in terms of what you're saying is using labour hire as a business model, why would a company prefer to hire labour hire workers than directly employ people?
Yeah, really good question, Robin. So the reason that, in my experience, the reason that companies want to use labour hire instead of directly employing people, there's a couple of reasons, but the main one is to avoid their obligations to these people under our employment legislation. So things like sick leave, things like annual leave, bereavement leave, these very basic entitlements that everyone expects if you're an employee, are more often than not, in my experience, not being received by labour hire workers. And I guess even more kind of sinister than that, they're often wanting to undermine the collective bargaining. So, you know, obviously if the 100 workers get together and say, actually, you need to pay us more money, they have a significant amount of bargaining power. But if we've got part of that workforce, say, for example, 50 out of the 100 workers being employed through a labour hire company rather than through the company directly, then there's a lot more what companies like to use call flexibility. Which, you know, unionists obviously call exploitation, actually. You know, flexibility is only a good thing if it works for both parties.
Yeah.
So they can far more easily dismiss these labour hire workers. So I actually, on the way here, was just talking to a young guy. He'd worked in a distribution centre for 10 months. He was about to become a permanent employee through some collective bargaining, so through union action, union members action. And I'll just take this opportunity to give a shout out to Liana, and who's one of our delegates at Cold Store for Foodstuffs, and all the other delegates and members at our Cold Store and Foodstuffs Cold Store who did take, you know, strike action, partly to support these labour hire workers who were working alongside them and receiving $6 less an hour, and not getting their sick leave and not getting their bereavement leave and all of these things that they were getting. So, you know, as someone put it to me once, we have to stand up for these people because they can't stand up for themselves. And so, yes, on the way here, I was driving here and I was talking to a young man who was a member of ours, but he was employed by Drake instead of Foodstuffs, and he was about to become permanent under our contract negotiations, and he was let go. And the story that he told me, admittedly one side of the story, but very, very, very familiar, heard it many times before, is that he was just let go. So he, you know,
no explanation, no process.
There was an explanation, just by, you know, whereas normally we would expect that there would be a process where, you know, you'd sit down and have a talk and get a chance to explain yourself. And, you know, what he did was very minor. I wouldn't even think it would constitute a warning. So we see that kind of thing all the time. So that flexibility, what that really means is 0-hour contracts on steroids. That's essentially what these labour hire contracts are, 0-hour contracts on steroids. So they can change their hours at the click of a finger, no notice needed. They can drop your pay rate if they feel like it, if you're not already on minimum wage, which is, you know, usually to be fair, these people are actually on minimum wage.
To be fair, don't want to pay them any more than that.
Yeah, not any more than you legally have to. And so, yeah, they also are used to undermine the union's bargaining power and often brought in, as we've seen repeatedly, as strike breakers. So, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's you made the comment in passing before about so that Coles store distribution centre and really, I think, so powerful and incredible what those workers did, standing beside them on the picket line, standing up not just for themselves but actually for their colleagues and their comrades that they work alongside every day that don't have the same rights as them, who could be just dismissed at the drop of a hat for joining the union. It's so hard for us to be able to prove that, but we know that that's effectively what the employer would do, and really hard for them to stick up for themselves. So I think that, yeah, people should take note of that incredible solidarity that was shown by those workers. But just one of the comments that you made was, oh, just getting paid $6 less per hour than the people that are standing next to them in the distribution centre. And obviously that is a very compelling reason for an employer to prefer a labour hire worker over a permanently employed worker. And obviously and you did a lot of work in terms of raising the wages for the permanently employed people, but it's a much different story and a completely separate process if we were to try and collectively bargain for those labour hire contractors. And I've got an example in my own patch where 30 random temps have been brought in. I asked the company, are these people going to be on the same terms and conditions as our collective agreement, as our members that are working alongside these people? And they say, oh, we haven't discussed the terms and conditions. That's a private business matter and that's not for us to know. It's like that is directly undermining our bargaining strength. And we've got a situation where people are second-class employees on the same site getting shorter breaks than our members, you know, just in a much much worse position, and it happens, I think, very commonly. What I think we'll do, Lisa, is we'll listen to another song. We've been talking now for a good 30 minutes about this, and there's plenty more to talk about, but we can have a break and then we'll come back and talk about the recent case law and the progression of that, but also what are the different things that can be done on a industrial level, but also potentially on a legislative level to help these workers and to get us out of this situation. So I'll just play a song for everybody.
Made my decision to test my limits. Cause it's my business, God is my witness. Stop what I finished. Don't need no holder, taking control of this kind of moment. I'm locked and loaded, completely focused. My mind is open. All that you got's gonna skip. I'm bulletproofing, know what I'm doing. The way we're moving, like introducing us to a new thing. I wanna save it for later. The taste of flavor, cause I'm a taker, cause I'm a giver. It's only nature, I live for danger. All that you got, skin to skin.
Something about you makes me.
And that was Ariana Grande, Dangerous Woman. And you're on Community First FM, First Union's community radio show, talking about the issues that are affecting our members, workers around the country and our communities, and what we can do about them. So I'm Robin. I am a union organiser for First Union and the retail and finance sector, and I'm joined today by Lisa Metall-Fox, who is a organiser for the transport, logistics and manufacturing sector of our union. She's kindly joined us today to talk about the issues facing labour hire workers or temp workers, what their status is, what's going on and what particularly vulnerable situation they often find themselves in. But also now we're going to turn to the recent case in the Employment Relations Authority that was taken by Air2, the union for the largest private sector union in New Zealand, against LSG Sky Chefs and the third party employer that had been providing temp workers to LSG Sky Chefs without any due consideration of actually the fact that, I mean, the argument was that these workers were permanent employees of LSG Sky Chefs, and the temporary labour hire arrangement was invalid, and that they and they won, which is really incredible. So the workers were, there was two workers involved in the case. Yeah, Kamlesh Prasad and Luiofanga Tulai, who both worked for the company for quite some time, often, you know, in one case 34 days in a row without a break, over 60 hours a week, really trying conditions, to put it conservatively, for those workers. And the fact that they had very little recourse based on their status just makes it all the more difficult. And unfortunately, that is a very common story across lots of different sectors in New Zealand, where third-party contracting is commonplace. And unfortunately, there is no accident that those people are in a vulnerable position, because that's almost exactly why they've been hired for that, under that arrangement. So, Lisa, maybe do you want to talk to us a little bit more about that case and potentially what the impacts will be for other labour hire workers around New Zealand?
So, this case was only came out a couple of weeks ago, and we were very pleased with the outcome. It was what we thought it would be. But essentially what it's saying is apply common sense. You know, if a person appears to be an employee, then they probably are one. And if an organisation appears to be their employer, then that probably is their employer. You know, it's easy to get caught up in the technicalities of, you know, parent companies and subsidiaries and the corporate veil and all these quite technical terms. But at the end of the day, essentially the employment court is saying, well, actually, you know, if you take a step back and you have a look at it, apply common sense stuff, like what uniform are you wearing? Who's telling you what work to do? Who is your host company? So that's the term that they've used in the cases. Who hosts you? So in this situation, it was LSG, LSG Sky Chefs. So Prasad and the other plaintiff were working at the LSG site for 2 and 4 years. Other things like, you know, what uniforms you're wearing, as I already said, but also how integrated you are in the culture. So, you know, it's just, yeah, common sense stuff. At one point, the people involved were employed as contractors, supposedly, you know, on independent contractor arrangements, and they signed those agreements. And then the labour hire company involved, called Solutions, put one of them on a supposedly employee agreement with Solutions. So the court looked at both of those things and said, well, actually, first of all, they're employees, and second of all, they're employees of LSG. They're employees of the host.
And I guess looking back on their pattern of employment, the court found that, maybe can you explain a little bit why they were back paid for 2 years? What the nature of that compensation was, or was it compensation, or were they not paid? My understanding is, and I can perhaps fill in some of the gaps, assuming that they would have been paid less than the people that were directly employed by LSG Sky Chefs, and if their two has been organising the site, they may have, very good conditions. And if the court found that they were directly employed by LSG Sky Chefs, and they would have been back paid the difference in their pay for the last 2 years, which would be a great win and prove a great point for those workers, but for many other people in the same situation. And I've just been reading in the media
actually it was even more radical than that. The employment court said, so just to explain, LSG were paying the labour hire company Solutions, who were then paying the labour hire workers, and the employment court said, well, actually, these labour hire workers were the LSG employees, you know, because of all of the reasons that we discussed. Therefore, LSG needs to back pay these people, and all the, you know, the minimum wage which they had been receiving for 2 and 4 years, it doesn't matter because that wasn't being paid directly to the workers. So they got all of their wages back paid, and they got them paid not at the minimum wage, which is what they were receiving through the labour hire company. They got them paid at the collective rates. So, wow. Yes, you're right, a lot higher than the minimum wage at any given year.
Incredible. And, yeah, it's an interesting balance, and maybe it's more obvious, obviously, not obviously, but Lisa has a legal background, so some of these things are a lot clearer to her than they are to me, who does not have a legal background. But in terms of the onus and who bears responsibility in that situation, LSG being found as the direct employer, that it is their responsibility to those who have been found as direct employees. And I guess the lesson from that would be, especially for other companies with these arrangements, that effectively they could be held liable as a company, not necessarily, well, I think the comment that I made earlier about another employer in my area, that, oh, we don't discuss terms and conditions with the third party, actually that I would assume that this ruling means that that's not going to be an acceptable excuse, that as the company contracting the third party employer, do they now always have an obligation to be aware of the terms and conditions for those temps?
Yeah, so I mean, that wasn't specifically spelled out in the judgment, but what was really clear in the employment court judgment was that while LSG were paying Solutions to pay the labour hire workers, LSG weren't following up to see whether or not these labour hire workers were in fact receiving their basic entitlements like sick leave, like annual leave, like bereavement leave. And so the court found that, well, you know, you were just essentially abjecting your responsibility towards these people. And they did discuss, you know, the fact that it was a very small margin for the labour hire company. So what was the profit that was in it for them? And, you know, I had a bit of a behind-the-scenes chat, I guess, and the reality is that that labour hire company was making their profit by stealing the sick leave money and the annual leave money from these workers. But even putting that, the wrongdoing of the labour hire company aside, or taking it into account, the employment court said, well, actually, no, they are your workers, so you should have been paying them. And I suppose, you know, this is just a comment that it could be seen as a form of penalty. So in terms of other employers who are exploiting labour hire workers in this way, whether or not they would also be held liable, you know, it is a case-by-case basis, but the judgment is very clear that if these, if it makes common sense that they are your employees, then it doesn't matter who it says in their contract is their employer or, you know, in the case of independent contractors, principals.
Yeah, absolutely. And huge step in the right direction, I would say, for New Zealand employment law. Are you aware of any steps that have been taken or any changes that are being planned for other employers that do engage in third-party contracting regularly that would probably be exposed to this sort of case?
Yeah, so both the Labor government, Labor Party, and the New Zealand First Party have campaigned on policies to eliminate triangular employment arrangements. So it is the position of our union, and also you know, reading into the policy, that labour hire companies should just be essentially recruitment companies, and you know, perhaps, you know, a day here or a day there, but certainly not the replacement of the real employer.
Yeah, that's great. So, it'd be great if they could just be banned outright. This is potentially just a side question and purely out of my own curiosity, but I have a lot of friends that are on just their contractors, effectively. They have no entitlement to leave or sick leave or anything like that. Is there a way, like, are you aware of any international examples where that arrangement can include those sorts of entitlements so that they have more protection? Because what I find is that what that means is that they get no leave and they're generally just completely, they have no rights, basically, but no?
Sorry, I didn't actually quite understand the question.
So, like, I'm a graphic design contractor. I contract myself out to different companies. I may be at a particular company for quite some time, but because I'm technically a contractor, I don't get sick leave, I don't get annual leave, I'm not entitled to anything like that, and I'm not a casual either, so I don't get my 8% loading to accommodate for that annual leave. Is there a way that particular labour arrangement can be improved, or is that just, that's the
reality? You know, in terms of contractors, the whole idea is that they receive a premium for their work. So that loading for the annual leave, the sick leave, the bereavement leave, et cetera, would be built into their hourly rate. And so that traditionally has been the way that contractors, I guess, have made their money. So you wouldn't expect to be an independent contractor receiving $15.75 an hour, you know. You'd be expecting to, you know, receive a lot higher than that. Maybe, you know, the independent contractors I know who are genuinely independent contractors might charge themselves out at $50 an hour, or sometimes $100, or, you know, sometimes hundreds, depending on their skill set. And so the difference between the labour hire workers and the contractors, genuine independent contractors, which is something that was, you know, talked about in the judgment, is that the independent contractor should have control over their work. You know, like, the classic example would be a builder, right? You get in a builder and you say, okay, I want you to build us a granny flat out the back. And this is what I want. And the builder can come and go as they please. You know, you probably have some expectations about when it's going to be finished. But and they can get a apprentice to come in and do some of the work, or they can get the plumber to come do the plumbing, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You don't control their day-to-day work, and you don't provide their tools. You don't pay their tax and all their insurance. All of that is going to be built in to the price, right? So that's a classic example of an independent contractor. What's happening with these labour hire workers is completely different to that. Most of them are extremely vulnerable, you know, and most people are either new migrants or perhaps, you know, sometimes first generation New Zealanders, and I think it's fair to say that the bargaining power in these relationships is one-sided. As it's mentioned before, they're usually on the minimum wage, if not just above. They aren't consulted, you know, there's no genuine bargaining over their employment contract. It's not that they sit down and say, okay, well, I'm going to be willing to work for this much, and I want time enough for this, and these are my hours. Yeah. It's all one way. It's a take it or leave it, is how the judgment puts it. You know, they say to them, here's your contract, either take it or leave it. And half the time, the contracts are, or employment agreements rather, are completely unlawful. You know, you look at them and there's stuff in there saying that they can, you know, fire them at will, or change their hours, all of these things, which we know is unlawful. And many times I would say that actually there's a language barrier, and that, you know, not all, but often people on labour hire contracts may not be able to actually understand or fully comprehend what is being proposed to them. And look, you know, don't get me wrong, there are plenty of I suppose what we'd call Kiwis who are in these employment arrangements as well, but it is predominantly more vulnerable workers.
Yeah, and actually if you are in that position, even if you are well informed about your rights and the sort of person that's comfortable sticking up for yourself in that sort of situation, by the nature of your employment arrangement, because of that precarious nature of it, you know, and the behaviour of the employers more importantly, you know pretty well that if you you know that the risks are high, that if you say something and you don't have anybody backing you up and you're not going to be able to take them to court, you'll just get rid of. Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our show. We've had a really productive discussion, and I thank you really so much, Lisa, for coming on to the show to talk to us about labour hire workers. This has been Community First.